Let's open our Bibles, if you haven't already got there, to James chapter 1. James chapter 1. There is a saying that says, life comes at you fast. And boy, it does, doesn't it? Life throws a lot of problems in our direction. As you try to live your life, it seems like life is just throwing one snowball of a problem after another snowball of a problem in every direction. And the book of James talks about a number of those. For example, let's look at chapter 1, verses 1 and 2. James talks about the fact that there may be various trials. Count it all joy when you fall into various trials, he said. These are trials. We'll talk about temptations in a moment, but these are trials because of your faith. Your faith is being tested. You are suffering because of your allegiance to the Lord. And so sometimes life comes at you fast from that angle. You're going through some trials because of your diligence and your dedication. Sometimes life throws at you this principle of temptation, allurement to commit sin. Notice in chapter 1, same chapter, same book. Let's drop over now and notice at verse 14, each one of you is tempted when he's drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Here's an enticement to commit sin. Just as you think, I might be able to get a handle on this trial I'm going through, then here's a strong temptation hitting you. But you're not through. Here's another problem. You may be overlooked or slighted somehow. James 2 talks about a situation where a rich man comes into an assembly and a poor man comes into the assembly, and people favor the rich man, and they say to the poor man, you sit over here in this, you sit on the back row over there. He's overlooked and he's slighted. I mean, you may feel like you're that poor man that's slighted and overlooked where everyone else is included, but you weren't included. Life's throwing problems in your direction. It may be you face a problem of ridicule. Look at verse 7 of chapter 2. Do not they blaspheme that worthy name by which you're called. Ridiculing the fact that you are a Christian, but there may be other ways in which you are ridiculed and you're made fun of and you're belittled somehow. You say, I'm facing trials and I'm facing temptation and I felt like I was slighted and left out and people are ridiculing me. Wow, life is coming fast at me, but we're not through. There may be friction with someone else. There's wars and fightings, James 4 and verse 1. Look in James 4 and verse 11. James 4 and verse 11 says, do not speak evil of one another, brethren. Maybe you think some brother or sister is speaking evil and defaming you, slandering your name. Wow, this is getting rough. Life is throwing a lot of problems in our, but we're not through. It may be that you feel mistreated. James 5 pictures where sometimes the rich mistreat the poor and withhold wages, where the poor is working for the rich and they work hard and now it's time to be paid and they don't get paid. That's a mistreatment. You may feel like you've been mistreated somehow. Someone did something to you. Maybe someone failed to do something for you that was promised. And all of that can be such that it's not easy to stay on track when life is coming at you fast. You say, I'm trying to do what's right, and I'm trying to live right, and I'm trying to stay on track, and I want to stay on track, but boy, there's problems I have to deal with. Wow. Man, it's like in all direction problems are coming. It's not easy to stay on track. In fact, it's easy to get sidetracked or even have a total, utter train wreck. And so this morning, let's talk about things that help us stay on track. You need to stay on track because this track you're on of living the Christian life is going to carry you ultimately to heaven, lead you to maturity, and ultimately to heaven. We need to talk about things that help us stay on track. The book of James just introduced to us a number of problems. What a pitiful book it would be if it introduced problems with no solutions. It doesn't do that. It presents for us the solutions to those problems. Some have called the book of James the New Testament book of Proverbs because it is full of wisdom, and indeed it is. So let's begin listing a number of things found in the book of James that will help us stay on track. You may be sitting here this morning saying, I feel at times like I'm getting off track. I feel like times my train's beginning to wobble and it may be going to wreck and I want to stay on track. How do I stay on track when life is coming at you fast? Here's the first thing. You want to stay on track? What you need is real faith. You want to stay on track, you need real faith. Now what that implies is that not all faith is real. Not all faith is real. Let's go to chapter 1 and verse 3. Chapter 1 and verse 3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. The idea of testing suggests to me that there is a checking to see if it indeed is real. If we know it's real, and I know it's real, and God knows it's real, there's no need for a test. The testing suggests here is what's going to put it to the trial to see indeed if it's real. Let's go to another passage that'll give us a little bit of insight to this concept. Let's go over to 1 Peter chapter 1. I know we're studying James, but let's go over to 1 Peter chapter 1. 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7 talks about the trying of your faith. He said, beginning at verse 6, you greatly rejoice now that for a little while, if need be, you're grieved by various trials. Very similar concept that we see in James 1, verse 7, that the genuineness of your faith, the reality of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire. Faith is put to the test and put through the fire to find out if it's real. And he said, it's like gold. If you could imagine you have what you think is gold, you say, I have an ounce of gold, and it is pure gold. It's real gold. You know, are you sure? Yeah, I know. It's real gold. Let's put it to the test. And let's take it to someone that knows what they're doing, and let's let this jeweler pass it through the fire, and it comes through the fire, and you have a quarter of an ounce of gold left. I thought I had a whole ounce. No, you don't have a whole ounce. What you found out is it wasn't as real as you thought. And it may be you're sitting here today thinking, you know what, I have real faith. My faith is as good as anybody's. My faith is as strong as anybody. And it's put to the fire and put to the test. You may find out it's not quite as real as I thought it was. I don't have as much faith as I thought I had. Not as real as I thought it was. Not all faith is real. So what is real faith? You say, I want that real faith then. How do I know if I have real faith? What is real faith? Here's what real faith will do. Real faith will endure. Let's go back to James chapter 1. James chapter 1 beginning at verse 3. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, endurance. That's not patience in the sense of being, I'm calm in the midst of the storm. It is endurance. You don't give up. Look at verse 4. But let patience have its perfect work that you may be perfect, that is mature, complete, that is entire, wanting nothing, lacking nothing. That expression, lacking nothing, is a racing term that has to do, you're not lagging behind others. In other words, you're mature, you're developing, it endures, it's deeply rooted. More about that in a moment. Here's something else, verses 6 and 7, same chapter. Real faith is stable. Real faith is stable. But let him who asks in faith with no doubting, for he doubts is like a wave of the sea that's driven and tossed by the wind. Let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. Go back to verse 7. It talks about the wave that is driven by the wind. Here's a wave. Then when the wind goes this way, it takes off in that direction. The wind blows back and it goes off in the other direction. It's not stable. That's the double-minded man. He goes in this direction for a moment, and then he's persuaded to go in that direction for a moment. Real faith is that which is stable. It sticks and it stays. Here's something else about real faith. It's not affected by change. Look at verse 9. Let the lowly man, lowly brother, glory in his exaltation. Well, that's pretty simple. Let the one that's lowly, maybe in riches, material things, when he's suddenly exalted, let him rejoice in that. Not like we may be thinking. Suppose you suddenly came into wealth and you said, I don't have anything. And then tomorrow you found out your rich uncle left you $10 million. You said, boy, I would be happy. That's not the happiness he's talking about here. Let's see something else and then you'll make sense of that. Let's go a little bit further. Notice he said, and the rich in his humiliation. What if you were the one with a lot of money and then suddenly you found out tomorrow you don't have anything. It was all stolen, it's all gone, it's all destroyed, and you've lost it all. Rejoice in that. You say, there's nothing to rejoice for. I had money. I had money in the bank. I had a place to live and had cars. I had to provide. And I just lost it all. Why do I rejoice? You rejoice in you made it through the test. That didn't change me. You see, sometimes gaining riches changes our faith. Sometimes losing our riches changes our faith. Real faith is not affected by change. You lose it all, you still have the same faith. You gain more, you still have the same faith. Everyone around you goes in the wrong direction, you still have that same faith. What I'm suggesting to you is real faith not only endures, it's stable, but it's not affected by change. It stays. That's real faith. Let's go to chapter 2. Here's something else about real faith. Real faith believes, really believes. You say, what do you mean by that? Well, let's go to James chapter 2. Look at verse 22. Look at verse 22. Do you not know that faith was working together with his works, speaking of Abraham, and by works faith was made perfect? Notice he uses the word faith. Then he says, and the scripture was fulfilled, talking about his faith. But here's what the scripture said. Abraham believed God and was accounted unto him for righteousness. What's it talking about? Well, Genesis chapter 15, God had made a promise that through his seed all nations of the earth be blessed. This was before he ever had a child. And the point is that Abraham believed that what God said was going to be true, even though there has been no evidence that it was about to take place. He really believed. He had faith. That's what real faith does. It believes what God said regardless of the circumstance. Let's talk about evidence that your faith may not be real. You say, I want to stay on track, but you got to have real faith. How do I know my faith's not real? When temptation is so strong, you start turning to a life of sin. When you have that allurement coming in your direction, and it gets stronger and it gets stronger and it gets stronger, and you yield and you yield, and finally you just give your life over, and it seems like you're just gone into a life of sin, your faith isn't real. You're off track. You're headed for a train wreck. Here's something else. When problems come and you give up on doing what's right, that's in light of chapter 1, 9 through 11. Problems come your way and you just give up on doing what's right. I just didn't dream we was going to have problems. I tried to do what was right and it just seems like life's coming at me too fast and I just give up. Your faith's not real. Here's something else. When faith is more of a statement of your religion than personal conviction, what do I mean by that? When we talk about faith, tell me about your faith. What if someone came to you and said, tell me about your faith, and you start stating more about what you believe? Or you start talking about what we believe. Or worse, listen to this carefully, you've got to call the preacher and find out what we believe. That's not real faith. When faith is more a statement of what you believe than real conviction that you have and a stand that you take, your faith may not be real. You want to stay on track? What you need is real faith. When change and pressure shakes you to the core, when pressure comes on, maybe it's from your brethren, maybe it's from the family, maybe it's financial pressure, like chapter 1, 9 through 11, or some other pressure, or some other change takes place. When change comes about and pressure is put on and you're shook to the core and you don't know what you're going to do, maybe time to look at your faith. Is my faith real? You want to stay on track? I say, well, keep you on track is real faith. Here's something else that'll keep you on track. Looking honestly at yourself. Say, I want to stay on track. You better do this then. Here's something that the book of James is going to tell you, that you need to look honestly at yourself. Now what that implies is that it's possible to look at self and not be honest. How so? Well, it's possible, chapter 1, verse 22, you can deceive yourself. Be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourself. It's possible I could deceive myself. Look at chapter 1, 22 and 23, the verse that follows. If anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, it's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself and goes away and immediately forgets what manner of man he was. He looks and he forgets. that talking about? Well, the Bible is pictured as a mirror. You say, well, a mirror reflects yourself. That's true, but you don't look into the Word of God and see a reflection, literally. But the reflection comes of looking at yourself by comparison. That's the idea of the mirror here. It's like looking at instructions. Most of us men, when we have to assemble something, you get the box out and you pull everything out and you throw the instructions aside and you start assembling without reading the instructions, don't we? And then when you get in trouble and it's not working, so, well, let me get the instructions out. And so you get the instructions out and you start reading and you say, okay, it says do put A with B and you put this on with that. And you said, I did that. See what you just did? That became a mirror. You see yourself in that. I did exactly. Then the next step is that you were supposed to do this before that and you did it reverse. You just saw yourself. It reflected your mistake. What I'm suggesting to you is it's possible to look at ourselves and then forget. You go to those instructions and you say, well, that said to do it the other way, and then you forget. That means you ignore. Doesn't mean you forget it. You can't remember. You just ignored it. I don't think that's necessary. I don't think that's important. So I'm going to forget that. Let's go on to the next step. It's not going to work. It's not going to come together. It's not going to be assembled well. And so we're not looking at ourselves honestly when I can be deceived and I am ignoring the reflection that I see. But let's go further. The warning was given in chapter 1 in verse 16, right in the middle of this, do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Oh, we can be deceived. Possible to look at ourselves and not be honest. So you say, I want to stay on track. So how do I honestly look at myself? Tell me how I do that. Let's look at some things in the context. Look at chapter 1, 15 and 16. Realize that temptation is from my own weakness. Look at verse 15. Verse 15 said, when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, it brings forth death. Look back at verse 14. Each one is drawn away of his own desires and enticed. See, it'd be easy for me to say, you know what, I was tempted, but it was your fault. If you hadn't, if you wasn't doing this, and you, it's somebody else's fault instead of my fault. When I realize my temptation is from my own weakness, I'm being honest with myself. Here's the second thing. Listen with application to self. Chapter 1, verse 19. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Look at verse 21. Verse 21. Lest out all wickedness and overflow of filthiness, and receive with meekness the implanted word which is able to save your souls. What am I seeing in that? That I need to listen to the Word of God, whether I'm reading it or listening to a sermon or listening to a class, with application first to self. I want to tell you, preachers, we are often the worst among that. You hear a sermon that's being preached and you think, I know somebody in the congregation needs that. I want to get that material down and I need to preach that for them. Maybe I'm the one that needs that. And are you sitting here thinking, I know someone who needs this application? First of all, we need to make application to ourselves before we make application to anyone else. Matthew 7 makes the same point. Here's something else. Don't forget what you see. Remember that reflection? We've already read those verses. That I look and I see what this says is not what I did, and so I see a reflection of myself. It's reflecting what I really am. Don't forget what you see. Remember those instructions? Yeah, I was supposed to put part B on before I put part A on. I didn't do it that way. Don't ignore it. You better go back and redo that. How do I honestly look at myself? Don't forget what I see. And then take responsibility for your own godliness. Look at chapter 1, verse 27. Chapter 1, verse 27. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: to visit the orphans and the widows in their trouble, and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. You may help me live unspotted. I may help you. But ultimately, that's my responsibility for me, and you are responsible for you. Take responsibility for your own godliness. Go to chapter 3 and verse 8. Do what is hard to do. The easy is easy to do, obviously. That goes without saying. But there are going to be some things in living the Christian life that are challenging and are hard. Chapter 3, verse 8. The tongue can no man tame. That doesn't mean that you can't control the tongue. What it says is it's hard. It's real hard. In that context, he uses the illustration of a horse and a bridle. And you can't really control the horse without the bridle. You can never trust the horse where you take the bridle off and say, he'll do whatever I tell him to do when I don't have any control. Always keep the tight rein on your tongue. It's hard. But you can do it. And that illustrates the point that there are other things that God tells me to do that may be hard, and I can do what seems to be hard. Almost impossible at times. That's how you look honestly at yourself. You want to stay on track? You need real faith. You need to honestly look at yourself. And here's a third thing you need. You need active faith. You want to stay on track? You need active faith. What that means is you're going to do what you know you need to do. Go back to chapter 1, verse 22 and 23. Very familiar to us. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Be a doer of the word. Verse 23, for if anyone's a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. Then he observes himself and he goes away and immediately forgets what manner of man he was. But the one who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, not being a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. Listen to me carefully as I suggest that that's far more than knowing and hearing and believing. It has to do with doing. Big difference. So he said, I know the Bible. I know what it says. I know what I need to do. Well, that's great. And not only do I know, but I've heard it. We hear that kind of preaching and that kind of teaching, and we demand that. Oh, our elders wouldn't tolerate anything but the right kind of teaching. And so we hear that. And not only that, I want to tell you, I believe every word of it. That's great. That's great. But are you doing it? That's a big difference. Be doers of the word. Let's go to Luke 17. Let me make an application from another text. You've heard me make this point before. You'll hear me make this point again. But in Luke 17, the disciples had said, increase our faith, Lord. The Lord had given them a challenge. It was difficult. Forgive up into seven times in a day, and they didn't think they could do that. So increase our faith. In other words, we're not sure we have the faith to do that. And so at verse 5, verse 6, verse 7, I'm interested particularly verse 6. If you have the faith as a grain of a mustard seed, the smallest of seeds, you can say to the mulberry tree, be plucked up by the roots and it'll obey you. You say, what's the point? He uses the smallest of seeds. What the point is that they said, we need more faith. We need stronger faith. We need greater faith. Our faith is small. Well, if you even have the smallest of faith, like the grain of a mustard seed, use the faith you have. And it'll grow. Does that make sense? Use the faith you have. In other words, do what you already know. There may be things I don't know, but my biggest problem is not doing what I already know I need to be doing. That's where our problem is. And so what I'm learning from Luke 17 is, if I just did what I already knew, I'd be doing well. And then I'm going to grow and increase. That's an active faith. But let's go further. We need to be doers of the whole law. Let's go to chapter 4, if you will. Or chapter 2, rather, of James. Let's go back to our book that we're studying. James chapter 2 says, if you offend, in verse 10. James 2 and in verse 10 says, if you keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point, you're guilty of all. In other words, the law, this was true of the Old Testament particularly, but the principle applies to the New Testament as well. It comes as a package deal. In other words, it's all wrapped together and neatly tied together so that I can't pull out of it what I want and leave what I want. If you offend in one point, you're guilty of all.
Verse 11 says,
one part's just as binding as another. What do you mean by that? Well, the one who said, verse 11, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. In other words, you find any two commands that are found in the Bible, and the one that gave this command also gave this command over here. You say, well, this one's important. Yeah, it is. But so is that one, because it's given by the same God. Given by the same God. You say, well, baptism is so important. Yes, it is. But so is worship important. Someone said the Lord's Supper is really important. But yeah, that is. But so is singing to God. That's important too. Someone said morals are important. Divorce and remarriage is so important. Yes, but being honest is also important. And forgiving is important. And on down the line we go, we just keep going. Notice in chapter 2, same context, 10, 11, now we're ready for 12 and 13. The point in 12 and 13 is we're going to be judged by the whole law, not just what part we wish. In other words, we're not going to go to the judgment day and say to the Lord, now I am going to be accountable to part A and B, and I'm not accountable to part C of the law. So don't look at that and compare me, but just look at part A and B. It don't work that way. God's going to take the whole law. That's the point of verses 12 and 13. Speak, so speak and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. For judgment is without mercy on him who shows no mercy. We're going to be judged by the whole law. We need to have an active faith. Now, faith without works is dead. Now, let's look at the context. We won't read the entire context, but let's look at verse 14. What does it profit a man if he says, I have faith and does not have works? Can faith save him? In other words, that faith cannot save. The man says, I have faith, but now he doesn't have any action to go with it. Notice now at verse 18, we show our faith by our works. But someone will say, I have faith and I do not have works. Show me your faith without works and I'll show you my faith by my works. Faith and works go hand in hand. We demonstrate and show our faith by our works. Here's an example or two, in fact, of active faith, which is what he's talking about in the context. Abraham is one. He believed God and was counted unto him for righteousness. Rahab is a second one, given at verse 25. More about their example in a moment. Look at verse 26. Just like your physical body without the spirit is dead, so if you have faith and there is no action, no work, it's dead as well. You want to stay on track? Need an active faith. Say, I want to stay on track. I don't want to get sidetracked at all. And life is coming at me fast. I want to stay on track. What you need, number four, is you need wisdom. You need some wisdom. Let's go to chapter 1 in verse 5. We need wisdom, and what wisdom will do, listen to this carefully, is give us the ability to see beyond the present. I don't mean some miraculous insight. But wisdom is like a pair of glasses that without them you only see in a close circle. But you put on the lens of wisdom and you can see beyond the present. Let's look at chapter 1 verse 5. Chapter 1, it just described the value. There is some good that can come from the trials. Count it all joy that you've fallen into various trials. Wait a minute, James. You're saying that if I go through trials, there's something good can come from that? Yes, exactly what I'm saying. Now then, verse 5. Look at verse 5. Verse 5 said, if any lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. He didn't shift gears. He didn't change subjects. He's still talking about the value of suffering. And what he's saying is that if you want to be able to see good coming out of these trials, what you need is wisdom. Wisdom Vine defines as the insight into the true nature of things. You're able to see beyond the present. At the present, all I can see is suffering. But if I go through this suffering, it's going to make me stronger. And I have to have these glasses of wisdom to put on so I can see through the smoke and see there's good on the other side over there. Now, with the glasses of wisdom, here's what I can see. Not only that, I might see consequences to my actions. At the present, I don't see any consequences to what I'm doing. But if I put this wisdom on, I can see through the smoke of what the present, and I can see on the other side, there's going to be some consequences to the decisions I'm making. I might be able to see beyond the present and see dangers to what I'm doing. See, here's what I'm allowing my children to do, and I don't see any danger of that. But if I see where that's headed and where that's going, with some wisdom I can see beyond, I may Now I have some wisdom and I see where the danger is. Or I might be able to see where my decision's going to lead me or my family. Maybe my toleration of something is going to lead to destruction of my family. Wisdom gives us that insight. Go to chapter 1, verse 8. Wisdom that's mentioned in verse 5 is connected with stability. If I have this wisdom, I can see beyond the present that is connected with stability. Notice that a double-minded man is unstable in all of his ways. The double-minded man is that man that he can go this direction or he can go that direction. He's two-minded. But the man who is wise in the context is stable. Furthermore, wisdom develops character. Notice in chapter 3, verse 13, there's a contrast with wisdom of the world that comes from beneath and the wisdom that comes down from above. And notice at verse 15, this wisdom does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, and demonic. That's the earthly wisdom. But where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing is there. Now notice verse 17. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. Wisdom develops character. You want to stay on track? You need wisdom. You need active faith. Look honestly at yourself and real faith. Here's something else you need to realize. Realize the brevity of life. Realize the brevity of life. Let's go to chapter 4. The book of James presents for us that life is uncertain. Life is uncertain. We can't assume there's going to be a tomorrow. Look at verse 13. Chapter 4, verse 13. Come now, ye that say today or tomorrow will go into such a city and spend a year and buy and sell and make a profit. What is the text talking about? What's it not talking about? It is not saying it's wrong to go to a city and buy and sell and make a profit. It is not condemning making plans to go there for a year and buy and sell and make a profit. What's he condemning? The assumption by pushing God out of the picture that there is going to be a tomorrow. God's not in the play. God's not in the plans. Our focal point is on ourselves and this life, and we're not bringing God into the focus at all. When I bring God into the picture, I do not assume there's going to be a tomorrow because life, verse 14, next verse says, life is the vapor that appears for a little while and then it vanishes away. You know the text well. Look at verse 15. We should live cognizant of the fact that if the Lord wills and I shall live. That's not a phrase that is a formula that I need to utter. Now, before I make any plans, I need to say, if the Lord wills and I shall live, this is what I'm going to do. That's just a formula. But it is a concept that if I said those words, I may be cognizant of that principle. You want to make plans tomorrow? Well, if the Lord wills and we're still living, I will do thus and so. Maybe if I say that, I become cognizant of that. Life is uncertain. Let's go further. Look at chapter 5. Realizing the brevity of life, I recognize judgment is coming. There were some who were rich who were oppressing the people of God. And so in chapter 5, an unusual shift takes place. By unusual, I mean, this is not customary, for example, of the writings of Paul or of even Peter, but James here turns from talking to his audience and as if he's talking directly to the oppressor. And he says to them, come now, you rich, weep and howl, for your miseries are coming up on you. For somebody, misery is coming. He mentions in the context that it's coming at any time. Look at verse 5. Look at verse 8 of chapter 5. Verse 8 says, you also be patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Perhaps that's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem coming soon. Some think it's talking about the end of time, and it's coming soon in the sense we're closer now than we've ever been. Either way, the point is that judgment can come at any time. Whatever judgment is coming from God could come at any time. Now, there's the danger of being condemned. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. I'm focusing on the word condemn. Look at verse 12. Verse 12 said, but above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or earth or any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. Here's the point I want you to see. Judgment is coming. It could come at any time, and there's a danger of being condemned. That makes me cognizant that life is brief and cognizant of what's really, really important. You want to stay on track? We're still in the book of James. James pictures for us some examples of others that will help us. Now, let's go back to that illustration I gave earlier. We're assembling something, and maybe I'm not good at reading the instructions. But if I could go online and find a video or pictures that illustrate this is a person doing the very thing that's written in the text of the instructions, that helps me a whole lot. I'm not understanding some of the details of that. It's not real clear to me. But what does become clear is when I see someone doing what the instructions say. So James pictures for us that there are some great examples before us of staying on track. For example, Abraham, he said. You want a good example to look at? Look at Abraham. Abraham believed God and it was accounted unto him for righteousness. Abraham stayed on track. You want another good example? Rahab. Look at verse 25. She was justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way. You want another example? Look at chapter 5 and verse 10. Consider the prophets. Yeah, like Isaiah, like Jeremiah, like Daniel, like Amos. You want another example? Look at Job. Remember the patience of Job. Remember the patience of Job. The endurance of Job. Oh, Job went through trials. Job didn't always do what was right, but he never got off track completely. He didn't have a train wreck like we might have had. He held fast to the end. You say, well, those are important. But I wished I had lived in a day where I could have talked to Abraham, to Rahab, to the prophets, or to Job. Then I would better understand. Do you understand that the book of James is written to people who did not personally know Abraham or Job or the prophets? They only heard about them like you do. They only heard about them like you do. And they were benefiting from Abraham, Rahab, and the prophets, and Job, and on down the line. But you want more? Look around and find someone faithful today that you know is living the life of a godly life. They're enduring. They're staying on track. They've been on track. Life has come at them fast, but they stayed on track. That'll encourage you. Now here's what these examples say. These examples say, chapter 5, verse 11, you can endure too. You say, I don't know if I can keep up. Go back to chapter 5 and verse 11. We count them blessed who endure, for you have heard of the perseverance of the patience of Job. What's that about? Job endured, you can too. What these examples say. Here's something else these examples say. Whatever trials and tribulations and suffering you're going through, they're coming to an end. It's not going to last for eternity. Here's something else they say. The faithful will be rewarded. Abraham was, Rahab was. You endure to the end, you'll be rewarded too. What else do these examples say? These examples say, be patient. That's the idea of remembering the patience of Job. Endure. Doesn't mean be calm, it just means you endure. Don't give up. Don't give up. Stay on track. Here's something else he mentions. Say, I want to stay on track. You ask for help. James loads us up with help. He doesn't just give us two or three things. He gives us a lot of information to help us. Short book. But one of the things he says will keep us on track is prayer, the power of prayer. But notice what he says about prayer. The neglect of prayer is going to make us weak. Let's go to chapter 4 now. Chapter 4, he addresses the fact that some are negligent in prayer. They fail to pray. You lust and do not have, you murder and you covet and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet you do not have, because you do not ask. Context is dealing with friendship of the world. You want to talk about things that makes you a friend of the world, committing adultery, warring and fighting. But here's something else that makes you a friend of the world. You want something from God, but you don't ask God to do that. You fail to pray. Next verse, verse 3. Pray with the wrong motive. Pray with the wrong aim. You ask and you do not receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. Well, I did remember to talk to God. I remember to ask God and I prayed about something, but my motive may not have been right. Negligent in prayer makes us weak. Now, when life comes at you fast and you're facing problems, the things that get us off track, we need to pray in face of those problems. Let's go to chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 13, it says, "Is any among you suffering? Let him pray." You see, trials are coming by. Pray. You say, "Temptation is coming my way." Pray. Pray about it. Look at verse 14. "Is any sick among you? Let him call for the elders of the church that they may pray over him." You're sick? Pray. Is there sin in your life? Is that the problem you're dealing with? Verse 15 and 16 said, pray. Pray. Look at verse 16, 17, and 18. It illustrates for us the power that prayer has. Now, this is interesting. Put this in the context where we feel like life is just throwing all kinds of problems. Just fires one problem, and then before that one's over, here comes another problem, and then here comes another problem, and then here comes another problem, here comes another problem. Kind of like Job. And by the way, Job is mentioned in this context. Remember the messenger that came to Job, and before that one got through talking, here comes another messenger of another disaster, and before that one gets through, here comes another messenger with another disaster. Do you ever feel that way? And what's interesting is in that context is his prayer is powerful. Let's begin at verse 16. He said, "Confess your trespasses to one another and pray one for another that you may be healed." Here's our phrase. "The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much." The effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Prayer is powerful. Now, James, I know you said that and I know you're speaking of inspiration, but I might need a little more convincing that prayer is powerful. All right, here's the illustration of that. Look at verse 17. Elijah was a man with a nature like ours. You say, well, he was a man of steel. No, he's just like us. He's just like us. And he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. That's powerful. So, James, you're telling me that he prayed that it wouldn't rain, and God answered that and caused it not to rain? Yes. So you're talking about, it's not talking about a miracle. It's talking about God's providence here. Here is an illustration of how the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Here's a man who prayed that it wouldn't rain and it didn't rain, but he's not through. Look at verse 18. "And he prayed again, and then heaven gave rain and the earth produced its fruit." He prayed again that it would rain and it did. Talking about the power of prayer. Prayer indeed is powerful. Finally, you want to stay on track? We're talking about things that will help us stay on track. Our brethren help us stay on track. How so? Let's go to chapter 5, verse 14. Time would not permit us to develop fully. We've done this in class before. But verse 14. "If any was sick among you, let him call for the elders of the church, let him pray over him, then anoint him with oil." There's a lot of discussion. Is that talking about miraculous things? Is that oil for medicinal purposes? We've answered that. I'm not interested in talking about that now. Whatever view you take, here's the central point I want to take away from that. Here were those that were sick. They were to call for the elders, and the elders come, and the elders help. You say, "I want to stay on track." Elders are there to help you with your problems. They watch for our souls. And that means we need to use them. In fact, what I learned from James 5 is use the elders. Call for them. I've got a problem. I've got a spiritual problem. I need help with this problem. And if you've got a spiritual problem and you say, "These men are not capable of handling my spiritual problem," they don't need to be serving as elders. Church don't need men that can't handle spiritual problems. You say, "Well, no, these men are qualified. I think they're qualified." Well, then they can help you with your spiritual problem. Use those elders. Elders are there to help keep us on track. If I learn anything from the book of Titus, this is interesting to me, that if this were a class and I ask, Tell me what Titus 1 is about. Someone say, oh, it's dealing with qualifications of elders, and you're right about that. But there's more to that. I don't think Titus 1 is merely saying, oh, here's qualifications of elders. But the book is about being sound in our faith. Chapter 1 is saying men who meet these qualifications are put in place to help guard and protect your sound faith. You want to stay on track? God placed elders there to help you with your problems, but that's not all. Look at chapter 5, verse 16. We pray for one another. Remember, prayer is powerful. Verse 16 says, confess your trespasses to one another and pray one for another that you may be healed. That's me praying for you and you praying for me. Now, we pray for one another in the assembly, but we ought to pray for one another on a daily basis. Do you pray for your brethren? Do you in daily prayer call out individual family members or individual families? Say, I thank God for this person and 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 that one and this one and that one and this one. You say, that takes time. Yeah, I know. Do you pray for those that have weakness? Do you pray for those that need to grow? Do you think for God for those that are good examples and are strong? That'll help you stay on track, knowing that brethren are praying for you. And then chapter 5, verses 19 and 20. Here's what our brethren can do. Help us get on track. When they see we're about to get off track, oh, this isn't fun. Now, this part is not fun. In fact, this may be offensive at times. But you say, didn't you say when we started that you wanted to stay on track? Oh, yeah, I want to stay on track. Well, one of the things that helps us stay on track is when our brethren come and warn us, you're getting off track. You stay on that, you're going to be a train wreck. Look at chapter 5, verse 19 and 20. Interesting, the book ends on this note. Brethren, if anyone wanders from the truth, wandering off track, and someone turns him back, let him know that he that turns the sinner from the error of his way will save a soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. See, brethren are there to help us. Elders are there. They're brethren praying for us, and then there are going to be those that come and correct us and say, look, I'm concerned about your soul. I'm concerned about you going in the wrong direction. I'm concerned. And they correct us and they help us. How to stay on track? Things that will help us stay on track. You ever feel like you're off track? You say you want to stay on track? James presents for us some things that will help. Real faith, looking honestly at yourself, and active faith. Having wisdom, a realization of the brevity of life, examples of others in prayer, and brethren will help us stay on track. There may be one or more present this morning who's not a Christian, who's not a child of God. Would you come believing that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God? Would you repent of your sins, acknowledge your faith, and be buried in the waters of baptism for the remission of sins? If you're subject in any way, would you come while together we stand and sing?